I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Kirk Ellis. He's a writer, a film producer, a historian, and he is here to talk to us, and we're going to be speaking with filmmaker Farhad Ahi in just a little while, but to talk to us about a film that is screening tonight, February 14th, at 7:30 at the CCA. It's called A Separation. It's an Iranian film. Welcome, Kirk, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
And like I said, we're going to have a filmmaker talking to us in just a moment, but you are getting to be, what, quite an expert on Iranian film?
Well, I've been a fan of Iranian film for many, many years. I think it's the most exciting cinema in the world, actually, and it's only getting better. And this film, which has received almost universal acclaim wherever it's shown, is a paramount example of that.
It really is. I saw this film at the Santa Fe Film Festival, and kudos to them because they brought it last fall. And now the CCA has it for one night only, so it's really a time to go to this before any theatrical release. But it's an extraordinary film in the sense that it portrays human drama in its most realistic and subtle and genuine form without the kind of, I mean, what we're used to in Hollywood is kind of the good guys and the bad guys. And this is the exact opposite of that. This is life as it really is.
Well, you've hit on the key point of the understanding of this film, which is its essential humanism, which is something that runs through most Iranian cinema, but it's particularly true in the work of this director, Asghar Farhadi. I actually happen to think that this is the best film of the year. Last year, this year, many years to come, and I certainly think it's the best written film.
From any country.
From any country, in any language of this year. Some of your listeners may be aware of the fact that A Separation is one of the five films nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. What they may not know is that it also received, very unusually for a non-English language film, a nomination for Best Screenplay. And I would say a smart bet would be on this film to actually win. Very few of the non-English language films have been nominated for Best Screenplay. Just a handful, fewer than half a dozen. Films like Divorce Italian Style that some of your listeners may remember. But the last time a foreign language film was nominated for Best Screenplay was in the early 90s, and the film was Talk to Her by Pedro Almodovar, who was also the writer of that, and he won the Oscar. And so we may see a very interesting development come Oscar night at the end of February.
It's interesting when a film from another country reaches across borders. And I think that a film like this can probably speak to anybody anywhere in the world. Well, why is that?
Films are essentially about one thing and one thing only, and that is people. It goes back to that wonderful line of William Faulkner's when he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he said, in the middle of the atomic age, he'd been asked whether mankind could survive. And he said that through the hope of the human heart, mankind will not only survive, but prevail. And the remarkable thing about what Asghar Farhadi does in Separation is that he creates a picture of life that will be a revelation to American audiences who only know Iran from the media. This is a profound movie about many things. It's a movie about class. It's a movie about the relationship between men and women. It's a deeply, deeply moving study of the relationship between parents and children. And it all works in the context of a film that starts as a domestic drama, turns into a mystery, and becomes a kind of thriller before it's all over. Farhadi himself has described the film as a detective story without detectives, and I think that is a wonderfully economical way of looking at the film. And it will leave people with a very, very different impression of our brothers in the Islamic Republic and how their lives in many ways mirror our own. And that all good filmmaking, no matter where it's from, and this is part of a series that's being done in conjunction with the International Folk Art Market, which we can talk about more in detail a little bit later on, but all of the films chosen for that series have one unifying theme, and that is their essential underlying humanity.
And what's so interesting is when you, as an American or a German or whoever you are watching this film, when you see it, you notice the ways in which the culture you're watching is different from your own. You notice the ways in which it's exactly the same in terms of the kinds of relationships that men and women have with each other. For example, the way children behave. You know, there are moments where the girl is running up the stairs and her dad is racing her up the stairs, and this is universal. It's probably universal among species.
Well, sometimes talking about our differences often highlights our underlying similarities. And again, one of the things that audiences will see in the separation is a series of dilemmas and problems that are posed to the two couples who form the basis of the narrative and how they respond to them. And all the way through the storytelling, you can see yourself making one of these decisions. Sometimes the decisions are right, and sometimes they have terrible consequences.
And making choices, I suppose, is the essence of life. It's the essence of drama. It's the essence of all moral dilemmas, is what choices you make. And when we talk about this film, it's kind of tricky business, because I would like to tell, or have you tell our listeners, the story a little bit, but I don't want to give the film away.
Well, one of the attractions of this film is that it constantly springs surprises on you in very subtle and meaningful ways. So like you, I don't want to give away too much, but in its most basic terms, A Separation is the story of an upper middle class couple in Tehran who are looking to get a divorce for the simple reason that the wife wants to take their daughter out of Iran to Europe to further her education and her possibilities as a woman. The husband is resisting, not because he's fallen out of love with the wife, not because he's a brutal husband, but simply because his father has Alzheimer's and he can't actually leave Tehran. He is the caretaker. So they are in this dilemma. And in order to resolve some of their differences, they bring in a housekeeper from a working class district. And therein, as the old saying goes, complications ensue. Through a very natural-seeming chain of events, an incident happens on the staircase of the well-to-do couple's apartment that changes the lives of both couples forever.
That's very good. You didn't give away the film.
I have some practice at this.
Yes. And I guess the thing that is so fascinating, and, you know, I'd like to say I've been watching this HBO series, and I'm about a decade late watching it, but it's called The Wire.
Very good show.
Very good show. And I've been working my way episode through episode, season through season, and it's one of the few American dramas that I've seen in which you can understand why every character makes the choices that he or she makes without judging them as good or bad. It's not a comic book. It's not a cartoon. It's not superheroes and villains. It's real people. And that's so refreshing, because we Americans tend not to do that very well.
Well, the phrase that critics use when they're describing shows like The Wire, and indeed any of the shows that are done by David Simon, a remarkable creator of shows from The Corner to The Wire to Generation Kill to the current HBO show Tremé, they always use the phrase novelistic, which makes me completely batty. Because what they mean when they say novelistic is that there's depth to the storytelling, there's depth to the characters, there are many levels of narrative.
And they can also take the filmic equivalent of hundreds and hundreds of pages to let the story unfold.
And that's the point I was getting to, which is that they have, on an average show like that, 13 episodes, 13 hours to tell their story. Asghar Farhadi in A Separation does a story of equal depth and of equal complexity in just a few minutes over 2 hours. And that is a remarkable piece of work. And I think it's important for people to know we have a very blessed film culture here in Santa Fe because we have curators like Jason Silverman at the CCA. We're often privileged to see films that don't really make it into mainstream release. And many of those films happen to be from the Middle East and from Iran. But audiences have been trained to look at Iranian films as a kind of equivalent to the late 1940s, early 1950s Italian neorealist films. And indeed, they were films made on the street by young filmmakers who used non-professional actors to tell stories about everyday life. And there were reasons for doing that. It's a strange quirk of history that the resurgence in Iranian cinema coincided with the establishment of the Islamic Revolution under Khomeini in 1979. So there was obviously very heavy censorship. But one of the things that you learn about censors very quickly is that they're not very bright. And if you couch your story in stories of children, say, like The White Balloon or Children of Heaven, people don't actually see the implicit criticism of the way people may be living their lives. Or you tell them in the story of grand fables or allegorical dramas. But Farhadi is from a new generation of Iranian filmmakers who were trained at the Institute of Arts in Tehran. And he actually has had a very successful career as a playwright. And this film is beautifully structured and written. It's incredibly economical. The dialogue in it is very, very pointed throughout. And it has the construction of a really well-made play, yet at the same time, it manages to be incredibly cinematic in the way that it gives you information within shots and through the cutting between scenes.
Exactly. We're going to get filmmaker Farhad Ahi on the phone in just a minute, so let's see if he's there. And yes, we are on the phone now with Farhad Ahi. He's an Iranian filmmaker talking to us from Toronto, Canada. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. It's great to have you on the air. So let's talk a little bit about Iranian cinema. You have been involved as a filmmaker for years, and I was just talking about this with Kirk. We Americans are kind of blown away at how subtle and realistic films like The Separation are. How do you explain that? How is your artistic and aesthetic and cultural training, what is it like that leads to films with so much heart and so much humanity?
As a matter of fact, in Iranian cinema, you rarely see science fiction and many romantic subjects or adventures or heroic, something like superheroes and something like that. You rarely see these kinds of movies. So realistic movies and realistic subjects are considered because of Iranian culture. They are they had very hard times during these 40 years ago until now, and they had many changes in our culture, in our society, in our economy. So they used to pay attention to these subjects, and filmmakers are one of these people.
When you think about how the Iranian Revolution of 1979, on the one hand, imposed quite a bit of censorship. On the other hand, there was a kind of flowering of cinema. How do those limits and that flowering go together?
Actually, well, limitation goes to the culture and limited some kind of subjects and some kind of styles. Wise people, smart people find another way to tell their stories. We had even more than this situation before revolution, and we have some movies before revolution that were to see, and they had many deep subjects, many deep visual, very artistic visual to the art. So filmmakers, every artist can find their own way to find their audience and to deliver their subject to them.
One of the things that I was thinking about when I was watching the film A Separation was, and this is the second time I've seen it, and so it becomes richer the second time, I'll probably see it a third time, is how the men from the two different classes, so you have one man who is, the character is an upper middle class man, and the other is a working class guy with a lot of debts and a lot of problems, and who lives in a distant suburb on the less beautiful side of town, and yet how similar they are, so that I, as an American watching it, if I were trying to tell which was which through their clothing or through their gestures, they are indistinguishable, whereas the two women, the wives of each of these men, are very distinct. What's going on there?
In characters, they can place another character. I don't know how I can explain it. Like, another very easily can be the other one. There are many situations in Iran or some countries like Iran, they are in developed process. There are many opportunities that changes their positions. The man who hit the wall, you remember, hit the wall with his head, he has a lot of problem because he had big goals and he failed. He wanted big goals to change his place, his position in the society, and he couldn't. He failed. If he could, he easily could replace with another, with the upper middle class man. And in Iran, all women feel very close to each other. People like them understand deeply each other, understand their problems, understand their limitations, and understand how hard it is for a woman to be in the society, work individually with a little girl and survive like that. I think it's Asghar potential to observe very closely people and find out these subjects, brings out those subjects, develop them, and present them. I think it's incredible, and his visuality.
One of the things that amazes me about this film is that it has a very deceptively simple style. It's very observational. There are no camera tricks in it. The camera is always pretty much at eye level where you would be as an audience. Yet you're getting a deep, deep insight into these two respective families. And I wonder if you could talk about that particular style, because as realistic as this film is, it's done. It's a very carefully rehearsed film with professional actors, which is unusual for the Iranian films that we've seen in this country.
Exactly. I agree with you. I think it comes from Asghar's perspective. He studied theater, performing arts. He is very trained in film script writing and playwriting. He used to, I know, he was a good writer before he participated to the theater school. He has lots of short stories. And he trained how to work with the actors. But I think it's, especially, it is his style to use a very professional actors and show and appears. They are non-professional, they're just living their lives, and use camera as one of the other actors, place audience as an individual observer into the scene, and involve them to the subject. I think it's his strength. He worked on it. He usually worked with actors very much, rehearsals a lot, and very specific dialogues. There is no dialogues comes from the actors. Always has written, and they work on them. So I think it's his special and his unique style.
As a writer myself, I'm particularly happy to hear about any movie in which there is no improvisation from the actors. And I think that's one of the strengths of the film, is that it has... It's funny you mentioned that he actually wrote short stories, because looking at the film a second time, and like Mary Charlotte, I'll actually go back to see it a third time, I was really struck by how much it resembled a short story by Anton Chekhov. It's got that real simplicity of storytelling that is so hard to achieve. The other question that we've been talking about, and I'd be curious to have your input on this, is that there are no good guys or bad guys in the film. If this were an American film, you know, I always look at a film from another country and always think what the American remake would look like. And the American remake from this would have a bit more action, and the characters would be less dimensionalized. I think we would see that one family is better than the other, one person is more morally right than the other. That doesn't take place here. Even the judge who begins and ends the film... and who you see portrayed as a kind of bureaucrat who's just overworked, you even have sympathy for him in the film.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I think because of that, we call it very humanistic. Because you can't consider anyone good or bad. They're just human. They act just like a human. And I think with this kind of storytelling, he can entertain, he can take audience into their seats and keep them and tell his story.
One theme that I think is also fascinating in this film, and like many of the themes in this film, it doesn't throw it in your face. It's subtle and you watch for it, but is the tension between a secular and a religious society, the working class people being the religious ones and the secular people being the upper class ones. And I imagine that reflects a much larger tension within Iranian society.
Actually, in Iranian cities, you cannot very sharply separate secular people or with regional people. It's not a very specific line to separate them and consider them as a secular or religious. Religion, because of the our history, is in our life. We cannot put it away. Even we consider us secular, we have lots of religious matters in our lives. So they come from the same point, but because of their ability, their capability, they change their position in the society. Am I clear?
I think you are. And actually, I have a question just to follow that up. One thing that I've always been curious about, whether you're looking at films by, you know, Asghar Farhadi or Majid Majidi or Mohsin Makhmalbaf, one of the things that you always note about Iranian cinema is how breathtakingly beautiful some of the images can be. And I've always been struck by that fact because if I understand the history correctly, Iran comes from a non-visual culture. It's an Islamic culture where images are proscribed. So how did this visual poetry develop?
As a matter of fact, that matter belongs to 600 years ago. From Safavid dynasty and after that, Iranian society has changed. Iranian culture has changed. They used artists to paint castles, all, and they published books, all posterized and illustrated. So consider Iranian as a non-visual or non-images society. I think it's old-fashioned consideration. But I believe lots of Iranian images comes from poetry, and because Iranian people very used to take looks to the movies, they like movies, they love movies, and movies and television, television in Iran has a very specific location in our family room. So visual arts and images, now recently during these 100 years ago until now, has a very specific place in our country, in our society, in our culture. And people used to look at the images and use images. We have very good artists, we have very good painters, we have very good cartoonists. So Iranian filmmakers use all these background to present their visualization, their image, present their thoughts.
This film, A Separation, has been received with tremendous enthusiasm all over the world. Everybody loves it, is moved by it, is intrigued by it. What about in Iran? How has it been received there?
In Iran, there is two different parties. One of them are people, and the majority of filmmakers and people working in cinema. The other one is Iranian official vision. You know, officially, this movie is not very... They didn't pay attention to this movie so much. It's a very complicated matter, and if I want to explain it, it takes very too long. But I just can't say they don't want to present this movie too much. But Iranian people like that movie. They pay attention to this movie. They vote to this movie for going to the Oscar competition and other competition around the world. They like Asghar Farhadi's all films. Asghar Farhadi now is a very well-known filmmaker in Iran, and everyone respects him. And he deserved that. But official looking in Iran is not good enough.
But isn't it true, Farhad, that for the administration in Iran, in Tehran, that filmmaking and films like A Separation are their best sort of diplomatic ambassadors?
I think Iranian people are, I agree with you. But there are very complications in politics. I don't know anything about politics. So probably you should ask this question from our politicians.
Farhad Ahi is a filmmaker who has worked closely with Asghar Farhadi, who is the filmmaker of A Separation, which screens tonight at 7:30 at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Kirk Ellis, we've, I think, done a pretty good job in talking about the film and still not giving away actually what happens in it. And once again, I do encourage people to actually go to this film tonight at 7:30. One thing we haven't talked about is the character of the daughter of the more upper-class couple. Her name is Terme, and I guess she is played by the daughter
she's
of the
actually,
filmmaker.
She's actually played by Asghar Farhadi's own daughter. I had an occasion to interview Farhadi at Telluride, which I believe was the American premiere of the movie, and it was sensationally well-received, and he was, in fact, present to do a Q&A with me afterward. And I asked him about what it was like directing his daughter and how remarkable her performance was. And, you know, really good directors can't talk about how they direct actors. There's a really instinctive thing that goes on between a director and an actor, and it's all based on trust. And looking at the film again, I really saw that in operation, because she goes through some extraordinary emotional range in this film. And it's the kind of performance a child can only give if she's being directed by her father. And what's amazing about the way Farhadi constructs the script of this story is that it starts as the story of one couple. Another couple comes into it, and their lives intersect and clash. Yet at the end, the movie is really about the effect that all of this has had on this preteen girl, Terme. And she becomes the moral fulcrum for the action that unfolds in the movie. And the end of the film will leave people talking for weeks.
I know.
About the choice this girl is forced to make.
The girl is forced to make a choice, and again, we're not going to tell our listeners right now about what that is, but it's definitely the thing where you have to go home or go out and have a cup of tea and talk about
you
this.
You do. You do. And because the film really revolves around the theme of truth. And I could certainly pontificate as a former film critic about how that is a theme that's used allegorically here. It's an implicit kind of criticism of Iranian society at present. But on an emotional level, on a character level, it's all about the relationship of the girl and her father, and how what happens to the family and how they get involved in a very complicated legal case that threatens this family's livelihood, where the truth actually lies. What does a parent say to a child to protect the child, and when does it go too far?
Yeah.
And that ultimately is the emotional heart of the film.
It also reminds us adults that children see everything.
They do. Children see everything. Children hear everything. And I think children are a lot smarter than most adults, especially their parents, actually give them credit for being.
We're talking to Kirk Ellis about the film A Separation. So that's screening tonight at 7:30 at the CCA, and it's part of a larger series put together by Folk Art Market.
It's part of a larger series called Folk Art Cinema. And that's three words with slashes in between them, but you can also read it as Folk Art Cinema. And when Charlene Cerny and Nancy Benkoff came to me and Jason Silverman to curate a series that would tie in with the major themes of the Folk Art Market, we thought that what better way to do that than through narrative storytelling? I want to be really clear about that, because many people would have thought that the most ideal programming for a series like this would be documentaries, and I respectfully disagree with that. I think that cultures express themselves through storytelling, and that among the various means of storytelling, the delivery systems, as we say now, in 21st century society, cinema is still the most direct form of expression. I've always believed, from the time I was a teenager, when I became a journalist, and through my own writing today, I've always believed that film is the most humanistic art form that has yet been invented. And unlike so much of new media and the internet, it's still an experience that you have collectively, in the dark, with a group of your fellow human beings. And you talk about and you live that experience simultaneously. And we've pulled together films from a large variety of regions. In addition to A Separation, we're showing the great film by Satyajit Ray, the Indian director of The Music Room, the first great film of the Mexican Golden Age, Maria Candelaria, two terrific films from cultures in Africa, Where the Stars Meet the Sea and The Little Girl Who Stole the Sun. And we'll wrap that up in July, right before the Folk Art Market, with a documentary that also has a fantastic narrative structure called Genghis Blues, about an American musician who travels to Tuva to learn the very difficult art of throat singing.
Yes, I remember that. And it's interesting that you say that storytelling actually gives you more of a picture of a culture than documentary. I've noticed, and it is a limitation that a very few people break every once in a while, but documentary has such a structured and familiar form, whereas cinematic narrative storytelling can take so many different forms and take so many more liberties and thereby tell the story in a much more poetic and, if I may say so, truthful manner.
Yeah, this is by no means to denigrate the art of the documentary. Documentary is having its own sort of fluorescence now, and we are seeing very, very different means of telling these dramatic stories. But the one thing that I think it's important for people to realize is that most often documentaries are made by outsiders looking into a culture and situation. Narrative storytelling, particularly in the age when it's much, much easier to make films, the technology is so much more accessible, they're being told, the narrative films are being told by people on the inside of the culture. And so we're getting a much more direct and a much more honest portrayal of this thought process. We don't, as cultures, we don't think the same. American culture, from the time of the first Puritan ship landing on the eastern seaboard, has been a linear culture. It's been a culture of achievement. And therefore, our movies, particularly our mainstream fare, tends to be this first act, second act, third act, linear film. If you look at movies from Asia, let's take an example people would have seen, a movie like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. That's not a linear narrative. In fact, you find out at the end of the movie that the two characters you thought were the main characters aren't. It's the two people you thought were supporting characters, and it's a completely circular narrative, like so much Asian storytelling. So it's important for us to look at how stories are being told, because it is a window into how we look at our reality.
Kirk Ellis is a writer, film producer, and historian, and he will be at the CCA tonight introducing and also doing a...
I'll be doing a Skype interview with Farhad Ahi as well to talk about Iranian film in general and Oscar Farhadi and A Separation in particular.
Okay, great. And that's tonight at 7:30. For more information, you can go to ccasantafe.org. And for more information on the Folk Art Market and the Folk Art Cinema Series that is curated by Kirk Ellis and Jason Silverman, wonderful film curator at the CCA, You can go to folkartmarket.org. Kirk Ellis, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
As always, Mary Charlotte, it's a pleasure.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program April Miller. She's clinical director of the Sky Center, which is a program of the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project. And there is a conference coming up, which she will tell us about, called Wholehearted Therapist, Wholehearted Families. Welcome, April, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, Wholehearted Therapist, Wholehearted Families, I mean, what I am gleaning from this is that in order for therapists to be effective in their work, and you're doing some of the toughest work there is in this world, which is helping people dealing with potential or actual suicides, you have to, as the therapist, have a lot of support yourself.
Yes, that's absolutely. I'm glad you picked up on that because it's essential to our work at the Sky Training Center, where we are training about 10 graduate students a year who come into the Sky Center training to develop themselves as therapists. We've been doing that over the last 15 years, and most of them are now working in our community, in our agencies. Some of them are heading up our agencies. So we have a long sort of list of alumni now over the last 15 years who have done their training at the Sky Center. And indeed, we are really focusing on how can a therapist develop the capacity to really bear the unbearable, because many of the kids and families that we work with are dealing with the most difficult of life situations.
So when you, I mean, you have these people that you are dealing with, these families you're dealing with, it's the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project is basically trying to help people before the worst possible outcome happens, namely that a young person takes his or her own life. But I'm guessing you also deal with families after that's happened.
We deal with the whole spectrum, Mary Charlotte. I mean, ideally, like you said, we're dealing with families on the way, on the very healthy end of the spectrum, whenever they're trying to figure out sort of how to sort of conduct family life, how to raise up children, how to develop the kind of skills that would build resiliency and resources for their children internally. We work with those kids and their families. We also work with families, for the most part, who are struggling with all of those issues. And then we work with families on the more extreme end, that where there's been a suicide attempt. We also work with families after there's been a completed suicide. So we're on the full range, really looking at how to front load things so that folks are building resiliency and capacity prior to having suicide as an option in their life.
For the therapist, and this term is intriguing, wholehearted therapist, on the one hand, you have to have heart or you wouldn't get into this work in the first place. On the other hand, you have to guard your heart a little bit, otherwise you'd go nuts after the first 2 weeks of work.
That's exactly what a lot of the training symposium on March 9th is going to be about, how to do exactly that, how to be able to keep your heart open without burning out, without almost, if you will, becoming as disparate as the kids and families that you're working with, because the stories are stories of despair. Often kids and families come in with very little hope. And how can the clinician, the therapist, the educator continue to hold hope in the midst of all of that unbearable pain? So a lot of our training symposium is going to focus on what we've been learning about how to teach therapists, how to teach folks who work with kids and families, how to maintain their own wholeheartedness, how to keep themselves healthy while still keeping themselves very engaged.
And how do you do that?
We do a number of things. One is we really honor the clinician. We really see it as almost sacred spiritual work, that it is right there along with many people in our faith communities. It has become sort of an essential role in our communities, counselors, therapists, mental health, healthcare providers. So we really want to respect that relationship, provide an enormous amount of supervision, which is often the first thing that goes when there's budget cuts and when there's stress and crises. We want to slow things down. We're really teaching clinicians how to sort of create a sense of presence through some of the mindfulness work, how to go inside and kind of build up their own resources, their own inner resiliency. And we're training around sort of things that we have found over the years to be very useful for kids and families, so that there is a sense of that was helpful, that was useful. Families gain hope, that encourages therapists, educators, and providers to also gain hope by watching some really hands-on improvement in sort of in how kids and families are managing stress.
What are some of the stresses or some of the stories that you see in these families where a young person is attempting suicide or has attempted, and I guess hard to say succeeded, but has completed a suicide? What is going on in these families?
The challenging thing, Mary Charlotte, is not that much necessarily different than what is going on in all of our families. I mean, families that kids and families are struggling with the stressors of life, school difficulties, finances, parents having two jobs, families breaking up, reconfiguring, bringing in new family members on a, you know, ongoing basis. One of the things that we're finding, though, is it's not so much the type of stress, but more importantly, how you handle stress. And some kids who are under an enormous amount of stress have the resilient capacity to sort of have the life skills that we're trying to package up to, in order to, for kids to make wise choices, know how to problem solve. This is sort of our menu of what we call life skills, inner and outer life skills, how to problem solve, how to sustain relationships during tough times, how to build relationships with people like teachers and people that can be helpful to them.
What are some examples of that? Like, what are some of the actual skills that you're teaching?
It's interesting because we had a project in town where we were running some groups for kids, and we were actually teaching kids how to go to a teacher if they were struggling in a course and how to maybe use things like thank you and other sort of regular social sort of connecting abilities in order to build relationships with teachers. And
you mean common courtesy?
Common courtesy, how to acknowledge I need help, thank you for giving me the help. Those kind of skills that we really are seeing are life skills, that no matter how difficult the issue is, this package of life skills, learning how to make choices, teaching kids how, and their parents, how to go over the pros and cons of different options about how to manage difficulties. So in our family sessions at night, we're doing that with families while we are concurrently teaching interns and graduate students and those working on their advanced licensing to do that, to develop those skills with kids and families.
And I suppose there's always, I mean, presumably the people who come in who are therapists who are being trained do have some life skills already, but I suppose you're always in a process of developing those yourself too.
Yes, it's like a concurrent sort of process. The supervisors at the Sky Center are teaching the therapists who are sharing that with youth and families, and we have found that the more we practice what we're trying to teach, so as a group, we are sitting quietly before our staff meetings now, taking a pause, learning our own mindfulness techniques, how to slow things down when what we're about to talk about are suicides and difficult family situations and very complicated ethical, moral dilemmas as therapists. Rather than rushing into that, we're learning how to slow down. We're trying to practice that ourselves. We're sharing that with the therapists we're training. And in turn, they're working with kids and families around the same sort of collection of life skills that we're calling problem solving, learning how to sustain relationships, how to go inside to create a pause.
And it's interesting, you use the word slowing down a number of times, and it seems like that's one of the hardest things to do in a world where, for example, both parents have multiple jobs and kids are always in a state of being rushed around.
Yes, it's a very hard thing to do, and we're trying to help parents find really simple ways to do that. Maybe it's just one or two nights a week when families can have a family meal together.
And turn off the TV, presumably.
Yes. We're talking to parents and families a lot about filtering, that adults have kind of lost the knowledge, the capacity to filter adult information from kids. Certainly the internet, the media access has made that more challenging of a job for parents. But really getting parents to sort of stand a little bit more as the gatekeepers of information so that kids are not getting the kind of information that adults are getting at the same time, but that parents are really seeing themselves as a filter for much information that especially younger kids don't have the inner resources to process.
Like what?
Violence, sexual information on TV, media, the evening news usually. Many younger kids do not have the resources to process sort of violent crimes in our community and still be able to go to bed at night sleeping soundly and comfortably. So we're really talking to parents about what it's like to be a filterer in their families and to create some rhythms and rituals where people, where kids and children can start to really identify a sense of belonging inside their own family.
So the event that is happening, it's called Wholehearted Therapists, Wholehearted Families, is open to whom? Therapists, teachers?
Therapists, teachers, nurses, healthcare providers, anybody who really sees themselves in a youth directors, people in the faith community, anyone who would see themselves in a role of being a helper for youth and their families in our community. So it's a wide range of those who would identify themselves as providers, and we're working with St. John College, who is going to provide the space for us on March 9th, and the registration is still open. We're looking for mostly folks from New Mexico, folks in our own community who are looking for getting their CEUs for their licensure, of course, as well as learning some techniques to develop themselves as therapists who can remain wholehearted while working with the most vulnerable and challenging kids and families.
So the website for this training, it's March 9th from 8:30 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon at St. John's College. And the website is wholeheartedskytrainings.com. And I want to also give people the number for the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project, which is nmsip.org. And the number at the Sky Center is 505-473-6191. Anything else you want to let people know before we go?
No, I also want to just put a plug in that the Sky Center is a free family counseling center, and we're training therapists there, but we're also every night of the week providing free family counseling for any parents who are worried or concerned. Certainly we don't want parents to feel like they have to wait until they think their child is suicidal. Most parents call up because they're worried about a sad mood, they're worried about peer relationships, they're worried about school difficulties. That is when we really want to start working with kids and their families.
April Miller is Clinical Director of the Sky Center. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.